This is Games as a Podcast. What's up, Ethan?
Hey, how's it going, Chris?
It's going pretty well. Today should be pretty fun. We're going to be talking about gaming on the go, including AAA games on mobile and the rise of portable gaming. Wanted to spend a little time talking about AAA on the mobile platforms. As we know, you can play any number of games on your mobile device, and a part of those are kind of AAA console ports to the iOS and Android to a lesser extent. Apple has spent a fair amount of time showing the technical specs of their devices. On stage at Apple events, you'll often see them showcasing the latest and greatest AAA game just to kind of show the horsepower that's under the hood or under the screen, under the Gorilla Glass. And I think a lot of people hoped that maybe this would usher in a new era of AAA gaming on these kind of devices. And what's interesting, or at least kind of what we've been talking about and what we think has kind of come to pass, is that it hasn't really come to pass, and that there are obviously a lot of AAA games that you can buy on these platforms or play on these platforms, but it really hasn't ushered in this brand new era of AAA gaming on mobile device. Don't get me wrong, you can play some pretty awesome games, but and we'll get into a little bit about why we think this is, but there aren't, and I think, Ethan, you can probably speak to this way more than I, there are all these games, but I don't think that any one of them has really been a breakout hit on that particular platform, meaning iOS.
No, actually, they've sold terribly. That's the unfortunate truth. And actually, I bought an iPhone 15 Pro in good part because I could play these games. Mm-hmm. I was really excited about it in theory. And I have ended up buying a number of them. I bought Assassin's Creed Mirage recently. I bought Resident Evil 8 Village, which was the first of the big AAA games to come to the iPhone. I bought Resident Evil 4 Remake, and I bought Death Stranding. Mm-hmm. The only one I haven't bought yet was Resident Evil 7 because I haven't finished the other brand new Resident Evil games that I bought on my iPhone.
Right.
So truth is they play really well. Now, of course, the major qualifier is they play very well if you are using a controller, mm-hmm. because that's how they're designed. So I use a Backbone, which is a great solution. I just snap my device into it and I'm good to go. But they drain battery very quickly.
Yep.
The overall visual quality, while excellent, still is obviously not going to match what you are doing on your PlayStation 5 or your brand new PC.
Right.
So expect to be playing at 30 frames a second instead of 60 frames a second, for instance. Nonetheless, it's remarkable that you're able to play these natively. But even there, it's like, what is the use case? I played quite a bit of Resident Evil 4 Remake. It was a great experience to do that with a Backbone controller on a plane. Mm-hmm. But the other ones, honestly, have been more a matter of literally popping them in for 15, 20 minutes, confirming that they work, and never going back to them.
Nice QA.
Yeah, exactly. And I like the idea that I have access to them whenever I want to play them. But honestly, these are not the first games I'm going to be playing on my mobile device. So when I recently was in a waiting room for a long time, I ended up playing Retro Bowl instead on Apple Arcade. Mm-hmm. Because it takes 5 minutes to play a fun game of football, and then I'm done. The problem with trying to start up something like Death Stranding is I have to get invested. I have to lean forward. I have to remember where I was in the story. Yeah. There's not an easy way to just get out when I have to take care of something like, you know, I'm up in line and now have to take care of that instead. There's just not an easy way to play these console games that are expecting you to have a 90-minute session on the go.
It kind of speaks to a product market fit, meaning these games are designed to be long play sessions, like you said, where I'm going to sit down at my couch or at my desk, at my computer, and play a meaningful amount of time. So I can imagine it just being very frustrating if you're standing in line and you fire up the game. I'm sure it takes a little while to kind of those title screens to come up. They're designed for these kind of bombastic, theatrical type experiences. And while the device can run them without breaking a sweat, well, maybe draining the battery quicker than you would like, it's a bit of a mismatch there, unless you are plugged in at home on the couch, and then you're starting to compete with the console controller that's sitting right there. You know, why am I just not playing this on my TV kind of thing? So
I do have an answer for that. There is a good reason, and that will often be because somebody else is using the TV. Right? So theoretically, that should be the optimal way to enjoy that experience. But the truth of the matter is, if I'm playing something like Resident Evil 4 Remake, even if I want to play it on my phone, actually the better way to do it would be to just use my PlayStation 5 Remote Play and stream it to the device, because then I'm going to get 60 frames a second instead of 30 frames a second, and I can still let someone else use the TV, and I don't have to buy two versions of the game.
Sure.
Because to be very clear, every game that I just listed as having purchased on my iPhone 15 Pro, I already owned on other devices. So I was double dipping. Very few people are going to be willing to do that.
That's true. And I think the majority of those titles that you're talking about, they did not ship day and date. So you talk about the sales being poor. If I'm excited about the title, am I going to just wait for it to be shipped on my phone? I think the publishers of those titles are kind of hoping for the double dippers like you that are a fan and want to play the game on various platforms and willing to pay. And then secondly, I would say that probably very few of those, if any, have done any consideration about kind of the user experience on a mobile device. You're, like you said, you're plugging into your controller, your backbone controller. Not everyone does that. And so a lot of people are probably trying to play it with using rather fiddly control mechanisms on the screen. And that's not a great experience. And again, that kind of goes back to the user experience. What a typical owner of a phone kind of expects from a mobile game. And, you know, we can talk about your favorite business model all day long, but a lot of players also expect to pay very little to none for a game on their phone, because they kind of consider it more as distraction gaming as opposed to something of substance, that kind of something that's meatier. I would love there to be a lot more diversification in terms of business models that thrive on those platforms. It's just, we just haven't really seen it come to pass. You know, gone are the days where Sega can ship Monkey Ball and charge $20 on iOS, which is what, you know, Sega did, as you very well know. We saw pretty rapidly price go $20, $15, $10, $4.99, $2.99, $1.99, all the way to the floor, and, well, not through the floor, but on the floor to zero. And it's been interesting to see some companies try to adapt to that kind of new business model, both from the monetization standpoint, which I don't really want to get a whole lot into, but also the platform as a new platform. So we do have these AAA console-like experiences on the device. But there's also companies that have tried to bring their IP to the mobile phone in a slightly new way. And some have been pretty successful, and some have not. And I think you were talking a little earlier about, you know, offline, about Super Mario Run. And I think that's worth a little bit of discussion, since Mario is obviously very well known.
Yep. But people were pissed when it came out and would give you basically a demo, and then you would have to spend $10 to continue playing. Yep. That people thought that was like a betrayal, because that is not what they were used to. And, you know, so I thought that the response to that was really funny. If I can share a quote, I'll never forget it. This was a GamesIndustry.biz. They said, "It's easy to see how a lot of people would have come to see the entry of Nintendo's biggest brand with a more traditional shareware-esque business model as being akin to a glass of ice water in hell. That hell's denizens turned out not to like ice water is simply incomprehensible to them and to me." I thought when Super Mario Run came out, like, okay, great, we can have people on the level of Nintendo making great mobile games. And I was hungry for that. Mm-hmm. I eagerly spent the $10 before even finishing the demo portion of it, right? But that is not the typical use case. And so I think that there's kind of a sadness to that, but that is what the market has dictated.
Oh, well, yeah. Again, I think it kind of speaks a little bit to the product market fit. I'm sure Nintendo made money off of Mario, but to me, it just kind of felt out of place. And not the business model necessarily, but it didn't really feel like a super authentic Mario experience. And I don't know why. I can't really put my thumb on it. It just did not feel authentic to me. And I do wonder if it would have been more successful if they had released it 8-10 years prior, when business model was still kind of something being experimented with. So I'd be curious to see how much of the hate was oh, this is a demo shareware, shovelware. I mean, not shovelware, obviously, but, or it just not really feeling like a great Mario experience. I think Sega did a really good job at bringing Sonic over to mobile. Certainly,
yeah, ported Sonic Dash.
Yeah, we ported a ton of Sonic games from other platforms, which you kind of have to play with your backbone to fully enjoy, I think. But Sonic Dash was mobile first, like Mario, but it just felt, the mechanic fits so well with the platform and the whole mechanic of Sonic running. I mean, that's what he's born to do, right? It's just born to run. And so I think it was just a really elegant solution to that cued to Sonic's brand strengths. And it was obviously very successful, downloaded hundreds of millions of times. Which also started, it did start paid as well.
It did.
And it sold pretty well. And then when we decided to drop it to free, it went bonkers. So I think it was kind of validated the business model, especially in our minds and eyes when we were there, that was kind of the way to go if you're trying to significantly increase revenue.
Do you remember the Starbucks promotions where when games were like $1 to $5, you could get lucky and Starbucks would work with you to have these little cards that you could get at the stores and you'd get the game for free?
Yeah.
That was really cool. So for mobile, I think the biggest thing is building experiences that are designed for the touch experience.
Definitely.
I think that's critically important. And actually, my favorite time in the world of mobile games was back when Sonic Dash came out, when everything was like $1 to $5, where you had Subway Surfers and Temple Run, mm-hmm. and Angry Birds and Flight Control and Cut the Rope and Where's My Water and all of these amazing, unique gameplay experiences that were coming from new people.
Fruit Ninja.
Jetpack Joyride, mm-hmm. right? It's like, it just, the hits came and came, and Doodle Jump. Mm-hmm. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Like, all so cool. And it was this like era of all new games, a new novelty every single week. I remember feeling like mobile gaming had arrived, mm-hmm. when I was watching Glee and the kids were talking on the show about Angry Birds.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
That was so cool. And obviously that turned into a movie. So I think that there are some things that were to the benefit of the art of games when there was still an upfront price, mm-hmm. because that tended to foster those kinds of new experiences where mobile, I'm not going to get into a mobile tirade for free to play, but it feels like we were boxed into a far more limited set of genres once we hit free to play.
Sure. But I would also argue that a lot of those early games were experiments, and they don't age well. And they also don't have a long play life. Like, I think, yeah. fondly of Fruit Ninja, but also a lot of it was just the novelty of kind of a new input-output mechanism on the screen. But I'm not going to spend 150 hours playing Fruit Ninja. I'm sure there are kids who have, but that's another story altogether. So I think that time, there were definitely some interesting and exciting things. I think from a game design perspective, it was kind of exciting to see people like, okay, this is a new way to receive input from the player. What kind of interesting new things can we do? And you get, obviously it's tapping and swiping. And so there's, you know, even what Epic did with the Infinity Blade.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool, but it was essentially Fruit Ninja in armor.
Yep.
With some other, you know, kind of guarding mechanics and whatnot.
And it was beautiful too. Remember, they were showing off what Unreal Engine could do.
Going back to the beginning of the segment where Apple's putting very visually polished experiences on stage to demo their hardware. But I don't think those kind of games bring you back. Although, you know, Rovio would maybe beg to differ in terms of them being able to build a very successful IP off the back of that game.
Well, and I think also what you're looking at is, again, form to function. One of my absolute favorite mobile games to this day is Lara Croft Go.
Mm, yeah, that was a fun game.
I think that's just a brilliant game. It won Apple's Game of the Year, mm-hmm. when it came out. And that, to me, was the path forward for taking a AAA gaming IP and making it work on mobile. So, yes, now technically you could make the last Crystal Dynamics Shadow of the Tomb Raider, mm-hmm. work on your iPhone. And it would probably be pretty cool that it could do that. But what was beautiful about Lara Croft Go was that it was made graphically to be very readable on that tiny screen. Mm-hmm. It was made so that you never had to worry about putting a controller onto the device to play it. Mm-hmm. You could just swipe, and that was actually more comfortable than trying to use a gamepad.
Yep.
And it was beautiful, and it captured the spirit of that IP perfectly.
Yep.
So I think that there's a way to do it and to incorporate these brands. Of course, Sonic Dash is a great example of that too, because Sonic Dash is a much simpler game mechanically in terms of level design than like a full-scale Sonic game,
yep,
right?
Definitely.
But there was something appealing to that that, again, made it something that you could enjoy in five-minute spurts. And in fact, an interesting game to compare that to is last year's Sonic Dream Team. That came out as an exclusive on Apple Arcade, and I loved it. I think it's fantastic. But again, I loved it because I played it with my backbone. Mm-hmm. And this is a game, unlike Sonic Dash, that really does require the backbone to feel good when you're playing it. So when I was raving about Sonic Dream Team to my friends, anyone who had Apple Arcade, I was like, you gotta play it. It's like literally one of the best games of the year, not just mobile, right? This is beautiful. And it is. It deserves all of those accolades. But they were not playing with a traditional game controller. Mm-hmm. So they were like, this is kind of mid. I just can't get into this. It's too complicated. Whereas if they were playing Sonic Dash, they would have loved that.
Yeah, I have to be honest with you. I actually sometimes have trouble picking up a game that makes me go into landscape mode. It just kind of bothers me. I don't use a backbone or controller or anything. So the idea of sitting for any amount of time playing where it's horizontal versus portrait mode, it's kind of mad to me. So I'm less inclined to be interested in a title that is in landscape mode on a phone. And obviously, a AAA game is going to be in that perspective because it was originally developed for those kinds of resolutions. So I think it's kind of a steep hill to climb for AAA games on mobile. I think without considering the specific UX for the device, I think publishers are going to be challenged to recoup a lot of their investment. And that's kind of, I think, why you don't see a ton of them. And the ones that do come out don't do so great. And maybe they're more considered to be just brand extensions so they can say that their game is everywhere.
Yeah, it's tricky, though, because now it's so hard on mobile with visibility and awareness. Marketing is harder than ever, so having a brand really helps.
Definitely.
Yeah, but again, there is always going to be a certain expectation from players of what that brand represents. So, yes, if you bring Assassin's Creed Mirage, the full fat game, to players on mobile, it is what the brand represents. But again, they're never going to say you must play this with a backbone controller or something like that. But the reality is, if you don't, it is so compromised that it's frankly not worth playing. And it says a lot that even though I was so excited that they were able to do that they were bringing these games over, because I haven't invested probably collectively more than, let's say, 6 hours in all of these games that I've bought, all combined, I think that it's just less likely that I will end up buying more of them. Kind of a, I guess, four times bitten, twice shy is where I landed.
Yeah, and I think one thing that we really haven't considered or talked about is the popularity of games like Fortnite on the phones, because mm-hmm. it is a thing and will become increasingly more a thing, especially since Epic and Apple have unlocked horns long enough to contemplate Fortnite coming back out on iOS. Kids like to play it on that device. And I think in order to avoid this going into a long-winded thought piece on FPS on mobile, I think it's more about the social connective tissue. So I think those games are social spaces for the youngins. And I think having a place to be able to connect when they're on the go, I think, is super important to them. So I'd be interested to see how much gameplay is being done versus just kind of hanging out and on an island building stuff and chatting and whatnot. But that's my supposition.
There's also the local experience with that, where I do remember when it first came out, it was such a novelty that you could play that game on multiple devices and carry over your data. And it was just one fluid experience. Mm-hmm. And I remember trying to connect with my sister, and she and her son were very into Fortnite. I was less into it, but it was easy enough for me to download it on my PC and for my daughter to download it on her Switch. And then my sister had a Switch and her son had his phone. And just we had these disparate technologies that we're able to just get a local game experience together where we could all play very quickly.
Yeah.
In a way that's very hard to do unless you happen to have every player with a Switch.
Yeah, or
something
with the same
like
console.
That.
Exactly. It is pretty remarkable that Epic has been able to build that and created a universe that people can kind of plug into from whatever device they want to play.
And that social piece that you're talking about also, that can be important enough where that is the core experience. So do you get less fidelity in terms of shooting when you are just clawing it without a controller? Absolutely. But if you're playing with your friends and that's what you have access to, and the important part is talking to and playing with your friends, that's solved, right? You care less about how pinpoint perfect you are if the point is social and not really to be the best you can be anyway.
Definitely.
So I think that it's interesting to see that something like Fortnite, which does perform much better with traditional controllers, nonetheless, people find a way to be successful, to hang out with their friends without that device. I would imagine that probably, 10% of people playing that game or less are actually using a physical controller if they're using the iPhone or Android. Same thing with Minecraft. I think that people just get used to grabbing an old iPad and, you know, using their fingers mm-hmm. on it instead of, you know, setting up a controller
right.
for that.
Yep.
So people, I think if there's a game where there's that long-term investment and you're playing with friends and it's social, they'll get over the challenges that exist otherwise. But I think that if you're talking about a single-player game where there isn't that kind of reward of playing with a bunch of people, you're just going to want to play that by and large on a device that you can have a big screen experience and just like enjoy being a part of that world, and you have the right controller in your hand and you know how good that experience is. So anything less than that is going to be unacceptable because you don't have something like social to compensate for all of the challenges of the setup.
Sure, your minimum threshold for acceptable gameplay kind of rises markedly, which I think is a good time to segue to the next kind of topic, and that is handheld games or handheld gaming, probably less specifically about the games themselves, but than the devices that run these fantastic experiences. So, you know, we've been in the business for a long time, and we've seen a lot of change, and I think one thing that's been really fascinating to see is this kind of rise of portability being a factor. And we're not talking about the rise of mobile specifically. We're talking more about gameplay on the go. Fortnite, I think, certainly has driven a lot of it, but certainly not all of it, in that people increasingly want to be able to play these games they love wherever they're going. So this coincides with the tons of technological improvements that have happened over the year that do allow for truly AAA experiences to be played on these devices that you can throw into a backpack and take on a plane. And yeah, it's a fascinating time right now. And I think it's only going to get more so that way, meaning I think developers really owe it to themselves to really consider the different ways players will experience the game and make sure that the game is optimized for that, or maybe even offer something different depending on the modality they're using. I think that's an opportunity for some developers.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I know that this might actually be hard for some game developers if they're making this experience that's meant to be played in a dark room where they actually encourage you to put your headphones on so that you get like pulled in as much as possible. It'll be painful to them to think about the fact that some people are going to be playing this on an airplane. But that's the reality. And I think it's important to be able to make sure people can play wherever they want to play. People have been scared to death of a Stephen King book while sitting on a plane chair, right? Like
Definitely.
that's how books work. That's how movies work. I did learn one time, by the way, with my PSP popping in a UMD so I could watch movies anywhere, that you still have to be careful what you're watching, because I put Hostel in and I was watching that and didn't realize that it's like the hardest R ever made. So when a woman next to me gasped, I realized that I probably should stop watching that on the bus.
time to power it down.
Yeah. But that being said, I am very happy with all of my other entertainment choices to be able to play them anywhere. And I do expect to be able to do that with games, and increasingly there is no barrier to doing that. The Switch, I think, really kind of kicked off that idea of you can have full console gameplay experiences on the go.
Definitely.
Because prior to Switch, it was always like you would have a game that was on Wii U that was designed for the home television, or you could pop it to the Wii U screen, but you had to stay in the living room.
Right.
Or you'd have your 3DS, which was a fundamentally different type of experience. And they made lots of great games for that. I'm very happy with the catalog of 3DS games I have, but those were not full console games. Nintendo, when they did Switch, they gave you AAA console experience, truly, I think, for the first time on the go, mm-hmm. but they also recognize the importance of the ritual of playing in front of the TV, that people like to do both.
Yep.
And so for me, the optimal experience ever since I was a kid was to have that main TV in the living room and to be able to play on that. And whenever I can do that, I will. But now I don't have to wait till the family's asleep to be able to do that. I can play it whenever I want alongside other people, even when the TV is being taken. And that flexibility to me, I think, has opened Pandora's box. I think many people use Steam and the Steam Deck that way, where they are playing many times on their desktop mm-hmm. with a beautiful 128 hertz refresh screen, but they can also easily play on the go and just save across the cross-play saves.
Oh, yeah. I love my Steam Deck. It has really opened up my ability to get through my Steam backlog more than ever. So one of the challenges I found was my library would swell, as most people's do, and I would have a real hard time at the end of a workday firing up a game and staying at my workstation playing a game.
Yes.
So I kind of want to unwind and pull away from the place where I'm spending, 8-10 hours a day. And so the Steam Deck just kind of unlocked that for me. So I was able to, power down, get some dinner, and then plop on the couch and have a fantastic experience. It's such a great piece of hardware. I like the form factor better than the Switch. I've got kind of big hands, and it just kind of works for me.
Yep.
And of course, I just love that it taps right into the Steam ecosystem. Not to mention it's super customizable. I've got custom start menus and boot screens, and it literally is a handheld PC. And I can also stream from my PC to my Steam Deck. So I don't have to, if I don't want to download a game to the Deck to play, if I'm going to stay at home, I can just stream it straight from the PC. So I love it. I think, I agree with you. Nintendo certainly kicked off this kind of new wave that we're in. And it's such a remarkable, refreshing change from where, if you wanted to take your game on the go, there were specific trade-offs you had to make and graphical yep. fidelity, sound fidelity. I remember having fantastic experiences playing Tetris on my Game Boy, et cetera, but it's a much different experience from just gameplay and overall experience than what we have today, where I can be playing Baldur's Gate 3 on my PC and then just move to the couch and continue playing it if I want to, which is, it's a great time to be gaming.
Absolutely. And the thing is it also makes possible for the first time this idea of being able to just play one game as your main game from beginning to end, where it's like a book. I do not like reading multiple books at one time. Mm-hmm. I have to kind of finish one and then start the next. With gaming on the go for the longest time, yeah, there would be great experiences. There'd be terrific like Fire Emblems and mm-hmm. Zelda games, lots of great stuff on PSP and Vita as well. But you would be playing your kind of sub game that was your handheld game, and that was on the go or when the TV was taken up. And then the second you had access to the big TV, you'd switch to your other major game, which was like a PS3 game or whatever. But it was always two different games, right? And mm-hmm. I just love now the idea that that's just one game. So you can get through one at a time much more quickly, fewer games left on the shelf, never finished. And yeah, just that ability to pick up a little device, press the start button, and you're in. Mm-hmm. And it can be anywhere in the house. It can be at Pete's or Starbucks, right? You can just have your me time. I think that is special for so many different categories of players. I think of it, of course, as the ultimate dad solution. But also, you have kids who cannot access the TV because mom and dad are watching Game of Thrones, go upstairs, kids, we're having adult time. You have, in Japan, people who just don't want to buy these increasingly huge television sets. And so it's just easier for them to have these handheld experiences that allow them to go to Yodobashi Camera and go into the park and play Monster Hunter with everyone else, including strangers. And we've seen that phenomenon, and that's awesome. And that's so specific to Japan that Switch is, as I understand it, the only truly viable console now that exists, because people just demand that kind of handheld play.
Yep.
Well, so I want to go way back in time for a little bit here, because handheld gaming has always been such an important part of my experience as a gamer. I remember getting the Game Boy and thinking that I would be playing nothing but Super Mario Land day in and day out, because, oh my gosh, this is Mario on the go. And a brand new adventure. And of course, what ended up happening is I quickly beat that over the course of a couple days. It's a short game. And then the game that really pulled me in and kept me hooked was Tetris.
Mm-hmm.
Tetris by myself, Tetris hooked together with other Game Boys to play with friends.
Yeah, the lightning cable, or being able to duke it out, your multiplayer experience is such a cool thing. Not remote, but like outside the house kind of things, like you're playing Game Boy against one another out in the wild, so to speak. Yeah, Tetris did it for me. I love Dr. Mario also. I thought that was a really fun game. Yeah, I have a lot of fond memories of the Game Boy. It was such a cool looking little box, you know, and it was just small enough, but it's like kind of the size of a book kind of thing. So it kind of just felt, it had a little heft to it. So it kind of felt nice to kind of take out and about, and obviously very simple controls, but some really, really fun games.
Well, it was very interesting to see Nintendo's understanding of the market at that time, because all the other companies, including Sega, were saying, you want a color display. You want better looking graphics. And Nintendo's like, nope, that's not what you want, because that's going to mean that your batteries are going to die really fast. And you just want to be able to play for as long as possible.
Yep.
And you don't really want Mario as much as you think you do. You want Tetris. You know, they understood what made portable gaming make sense. And that is also looking at Pokemon.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that took off during that black and white Game Boy era and just became the most popular brand of all time. As I understand it, it is to this day, the most popular brand that exists in all of media. And that came from the Game Boy.
Yep.
And so there were a bunch of also RANs, but we didn't really move to full color until the Game Boy Advance, which, again, that machine was not backlit at the start. If you remember, it was still very hard to see, but they just knew that the importance was getting as much out of those two AA batteries as you possibly could.
Yeah. I also have very fond memories of the DS, just because it was
another
evolution of handheld gaming, insofar, you know, the two screens, the touch sense that, you know, you could take input on the screen itself, just allowed for so many interesting creative games to be made that really haven't been made since. I would love to see like Rub Rabbits on the iOS, you know, why not? And Feel the Magic, those kind of games. Just so cool. Such interesting, innovative designs around the kind of the two screens. And again, I don't think we really had anything like the DS in that respect.
Well, so a couple stories about Rub Rabbits. The very first game was actually a launch game, which was called Feel the Magic XXXY, which is a terrible title, but
terrible name.
Fantastic game. And I remember going to Nintendo's event where we were all showing our launch games, and there was like Spider-Man 2, and I believe there was like a Lord of the Rings game and stuff. Very, very familiar branded stuff. And then we had this batshit insane Feel the Magic game. And Jeff Keighley was there just as a journalist. And he came to interview me because he was like, dude, this is actually the best game at the launch of the DS. And I couldn't agree more, right? But they were able to, those developers of Sonic Team that was doing it, mm-hmm. they were encouraged to do anything and everything. And legend has it, and I cannot confirm this, I haven't seen the game design docs, it was just a legend or rumor at the time, that one of the mini games they wanted to do would have required you to lick the screen, which Nintendo said, nope, we're not going there. But you got to admire just the creative impulse to literally try anything.
Try everything, you know? Yeah. I mean, I remember some you had to blow into the mic. Yeah, they definitely took all the unique features and tried to do as many interesting things with it, and that's fantastic.
Yeah, so that was also a really interesting example of Nintendo. I believe, probably trying to avoid piracy by being in a position to make games that couldn't be ported over to the PC and played easily, because you had these two screens and you had the stylus, and it just would not be easy to take that and just port it to any other device. You had to be playing that experience on the machine it was made for.
Yeah, for sure. I'm sure it that was definitely a consideration, I think.
But, you know, the other thing that really struck me is when we got to the 3DS era, and I was so excited about all the different things that this machine could do. And, oh no, pardon me, this was DS still. Wow, DS has so many bangers. But like, Nintendogs is what I'm trying to get to, right? So when Nintendogs came out, when I would show people that game, I'd be like, look at what Nintendo has done to take advantage of all of the unique features of this machine. And I would impress my techie friends with that. But my wife really got into that game. And instead of talking about the touch control or the microphone or anything, she would just show the game to her friends and say, look at my dog.
Exactly.
And she just cut to the chase, and she's like, it can follow my commands. It can sit. It can run. I can pet it. How cool is that? I can give it a bath. And she was just so excited about the experience of a dog. She's a dog lover. At the time, we had an apartment that didn't allow dogs, so it was perfect.
Definitely.
But, you know, I just thought that that was such an interesting thing to break through to that broader, more casual audience. Think about Brain Games. Remember how popular that was?
Oh, yeah. I loved that. That was a lot of fun. Brain boosting.
Yep.
Total sci-fi gobbledygook. Or not sci-fi, but science gobbledygook. It was fun to play.
Well, and it also got people over the hump of, like, if you thought gaming was a bad habit, this gave you the better feeling of, like, this is something that is beneficial. It's like eating your vitamins.
Ostensibly, yes. Ostensibly.
Ostensibly.
I always was hoping that Sega would do Seaman for DS. I thought that that would have been pretty fun.
That would be a perfect fit too. Yeah, absolutely. But I remember there, we had talked about visual novels just earlier in the episode, but there is one called Hotel Dusk where you had to hold the DS in a vertical mode.
Mm.
And you'd open it up like a book.
Oh, cool.
And you'd turn the pages like a book. And that I also thought was a super cool application. But then, like, when we moved from the DS to then the PSP, do you remember how excited people got about how slick that thing
was? Yeah, I mean, it was so well designed and such a cool piece of hardware. It really, really was neat.
PSP was like PS2 on the go.
Yeah.
And it had Ridge Racer. And I remember being at Sega when PSP came out, and there was a game called Untold Legends that was just four-player Diablo, basically. And me and Jenny Sue and Vincent Chin and a bunch of other friends of ours, like, would rotate and just sit on beanbags and play after hours. And it was just so much fun. And we all had our own screen, and that was that just great kind of communal experience. And then playing UMD movies at the time, I remember, like, I have watched Hitch, the Will Smith movie, four times in my life because I had the UMD.
Yeah.
It just came with the
You ran out
the,
of options.
The machine, yeah.
Well, mine came with Spider-Man, but
yeah. So I mean, you know, that was just so impressive, though, that, you know, being able to play Metal Gear Solid on there, and the little kind of analog slider was not really a replacement for a full analog stick, but it gave you more than you had before and allowed you to...
Yeah, Lumines. I love that game on the PSP.
Oh, Lumines is great.
So great.
Yeah, Patapon. I don't know if you ever played that one. But there's just this great catalog. Jeanne d'Arc was a game that was an RPG. It got me into strategy RPG for the first time. I kind of missed the boat with Final Fantasy Tactics and Advance Wars, but that game from Square was just the bee's knees for me. And yeah, it's just, it was really interesting to see, like, kind of that first feeling of, like, true console gaming on a handheld. And then Vita really nailed that. That was something that, you know, twin analog sticks, you were playing Uncharted, an exclusive Uncharted game on the go at launch.
Yeah.
Think about how much that should have moved the needle. They had the Marvel vs. Capcom game. They had so many terrific launch experiences, including Lumines, right, that should have moved the needle. And yet that thing just bombed. And I think a big part of it was, at the time, people were trying to figure out, do I really need a handheld because I'm now playing Angry Birds and Cut the Rope and all this other fun stuff on my mobile device?
Yeah, I think they were unfairly compared, I think, to these mobile experiences. And I think maybe I have a PlayStation. Do I really need to spend another PlayStation's worth for this kind of portable device that
Yep.
didn't offer quite the same fidelity. You still have some pretty cool experiences, but it wasn't quite there. And I think that's what really differentiates the now from that time, and why those consoles weren't as successful as what we're seeing kind of today with the rise of the Steam Deck and, of course, Switch. And Switch 2, I'm sure, will no doubt be pretty popular. And we see the other consoles. I know you spent a lot of time on your PlayStation Portal.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and just another great way to be able to access, content that's on my PS5. Mm-hmm. But I remember the 3DS also, how impactful it was to see a screen for the first time that actually gave you real stereoscopic 3D without glasses.
Yeah, that was neat.
But of course, the problem is most people just turn that off after the novelty wore off.
Yeah, yeah. It did seem more kind of novelty. And you kind of have to design it or build it for that specific console for the device. And it's not something you can kind of reuse for another console. So people weren't as motivated to kind of optimize for that platform.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And I remember it was a shock when it launched, because I went into Toys R Us expecting a massive line and expecting that, like, since I came at like 11 in the afternoon instead of first thing in the morning, that there would be no machines. And they had them stacked up. There were plenty left. That was one bad sign. And then they ended up dropping the price in 6 months by $80.
Yeah.
Which... that's not a great sign either. And then, of course, they got Mario and they got Zelda and they got all the stuff that drove people to the machine. But it wasn't the 3D that got people excited. At the end, it was just more great Nintendo brands.
Yeah, it's the software. And I think kind of speaks to this idea that you can never underestimate the power of software driving adoption. It's Nintendo's superpower. We've seen them do it time and time again. And not just Nintendo, though. I think similarly, though not handheld, Valve drove adoption of Steam because it was the only way to play Half-Life 2. So good software can move units. And what's interesting now is it's maybe becoming increasingly less the case because, well, it does move units, but I think the days of exclusivity are probably becoming fewer and far between. Nintendo's an outlier, I guess, because they are an island unto themselves. But the other two big boys, Sony and Microsoft, I think exclusivity is going to become less and less an issue, especially if you're a PC gamer, because I think you can expect to play almost every major AAA gaming experience on the PC. Maybe not always day and date with the console, but eventually you'll be able to, because you've got to get the recoup on the investment. But that's kind of beside the point. My point was mostly you will pick up a Switch to play the latest Mario and also to be able to play it on the go. So it's not just the amazing hardware, the software is also meaningfully contributes to one's purchase decisions, I think.
Well, and to exactly that point, Chris, when I first got my Steam Deck, the very first games I played through on it was Spider-Man and Horizon Zero Dawn and Days Gone, all Sony games.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because I just love the idea that I could play these Sony games in such a great package on the go.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I got three words for you: Steam Deck verified. I just love that Steam makes it very easy to see when a game is going to run properly on your device and when it's not.
Mm-hmm.
And even there, you get that 2-hour window where you can return a game if it just doesn't run as well as you had hoped.
Yep. But I think they definitely err on the side of it running well. There are plenty of games that have the little yellow exclamation marker or whatever they use for not verified playable, but there's some considerations to be made. Like, a lot of times it's menus and things like that look kind of crowded because of smaller screen size. But there's things that are completely unverified that are playable. And again, the device is pretty hacky in terms of customizable and stuff. So you can actually squeeze performance out of it to suit a specific game. So if you're really dying to play on a game that isn't officially supported, you can sometimes make it work if you're willing to spend some time under the hood and tweaking different settings and whatnot, which is really fun.
Well, so the best PC experience, I think, in terms of usability and comfort is definitely the Steam Deck. Valve knows what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I do got to say, I've had some really good experience with the ROG Ally for a couple of reasons. That's one of their major competitors. It really is just a laptop with controllers jammed to the sides. It literally runs Windows.
Mm-hmm.
And what you get for that, the biggest benefit is Game Pass and Epic Game Store, which, yes, you can get those running on the Steam Deck, but it's just much easier to do it on the ROG Ally.
Yeah, it works out of the box.
Exactly. It is a little more powerful also. And you can buy a dock for it, which I have done, which is basically like a 3080 GPU that you connect to it. So when you run it on your television, it's like running with the power of that GPU, which is a pretty cool thing
that, cool.
That you can do. It's expensive. It cost me $1,000 to just get that dock.
Wow.
It was a worthwhile experiment, and I still use it to this day. But the other thing that I really like is, just like with PS Portal, is a great experience to be able to have those PS5 games streamed. I use the ROG Ally whenever I want to stream from Xbox as well. You just turn on the Xbox app, and it's as easy as using PS Portal. And so that is a really nice experience when I just want to stream my Xbox from anywhere in the house, just like my PlayStation.
For sure. I think as gamers, we have a lot of really interesting options to play games the way we want to play them. And I think it's only going to probably get better. I think the rise of cloud gaming offers a lot more flexibility for players as well. Obviously, you need a pretty beefy internet connection, so maybe it's less gaming on the go and it's more couch gaming, unless you're traveling somewhere where you know there's going to be great Wi-Fi. But actually, I think starting next year, United's going to be offering Starlink internet service on the plane. So maybe,
oh, nice.
Maybe you'll actually be able to get a decent cloud gaming performance on a plane. So again, I think if you are able to, you know, really for as a developer, you know, making these games, you really want to consider again where the player is going to or possibly could play and try to optimize the experience for it. Obviously, getting that checkmark verified by Steam is a huge thing for a lot of PC developers. I think increasingly first parties are going to have probably standards developed around those kind of portability play on the go. So I think they owe it to themselves to do that. Similarly, I think consider offline play for those who really want to play on the go. So like, can you play the game without an internet connection? A lot of games require them, even if they're not explicitly online multiplayer. Obviously, you know, your MOBAs and your FPSs, networked FPSs, are kind of a non-starter unless you want to take the time to build a robust single player experience, which we talked about in a previous podcast. That's probably not going to happen. Again, I think opening up new ways to play, like the 1v1 local multiplayer, I think becomes more and more of a thing, a possibility. So, you know, we've gone from, you know, chaining Xboxes together to get a true multiplayer experience to four screens on a TV back to kind of these networked, being able to network these devices to get some cool things. So hopefully we'll see some pretty innovative game modes, at least, to if not just outright game experiences that kind of take the portability of a game into account. So I look forward to what the future may hold.
Yeah, and with those local experiences, it doesn't have to be something competitive and aggressive like Splatoon, say. One of our favorite things to do when we're in the car and we're going on a long trip, the family of four, one person's driving, the other three are using their Switches and playing Uno. And that's just such a great, easy thing to do while we're chatting and low-key. But again, another use case that's fantastic for this. So I think, Chris, we have been able to definitively answer the question, are all games ultimately going to be mobile? Because you've asserted, I think, very reasonably that all games eventually do become PC games. God of War Ragnarok, I believe, is coming out on PC this week. So that's just another example of a once-exclusive big PS5 game that is playable now for everyone.
Yeah.
Game Pass brings everything to PC. So everything except Nintendo ultimately will come to Steam Deck and ROG Ally and all of those handheld devices. And Nintendo is now committed to making everything handheld.
Yeah, handheld is the future.
Yeah, so I think developers really should think carefully, as you were saying, about the fact that many players will really want to have that experience on the go.
Yeah, definitely. I couldn't agree more. And what do you listeners think? We'd love to hear your opinions on things. And cool discussion, Ethan, as always. Any closing thoughts? Are you good?
Actually, I'll say one last thing about handheld gaming, something that I have really loved and loved so much that I brought my son into the fold. Have you heard of the game company Analog, the hardware game company?
Yes, I have. Very kind of lo-fi games, but it's a very, almost futuristic looking play device. Is that right?
Yeah. So they created a Super Nintendo machine that has HDMI in. They did the same thing with the Genesis, and they really hit pay dirt when they did it with Game Boy. So you can get something that's called an Analog Pocket, which is basically a Game Boy with a LCD screen that is 10 times the resolution of the original Game Boy, and okay. It runs original Game Boy cartridges.
Wow.
And so it's really fun to pop those games in, and now they are razor sharp with a perfect screen. So you still get that great experience of going to the retro game store, finding something special, popping it in. But now you can play it at a level that you never could before in terms of fidelity. And they have a dock, so you can dock it and just play it on your TV. So
oh, cool.
I recently played through the Minish Cap, the Zelda game, that way. And it was super fun. Like the Switch, I could play on the go, I could play on the big screen, and I could enjoy going to that used game store and finding the cartridge in the first place.
Yeah, I like that a lot. It, you know, it's a new way to experience some older games and maybe, you know, fall in love with some of your all-time greats, as well as find some new hits.
Yeah. That's just my last suggestion. Chris, thanks so much for chatting. I always love talking about classic games, and I guess I'll try to find a multiplayer game to play with you sometime soon.
Yeah, sounds great. And thanks for listening, everyone. And I'll see you next time.